welcome to another episode of the Roost Podcast. As always, I am Carter Spires, here with my co-host Matthew Bartlett, the founder and managing editor of The Roost, your premier source for Rice sports news and analysis. Thanks to everybody for listening along to our extended off-season interview series so far. I was actually just checking the calendar. We've now been doing it basically one a week for two solid months. So, pretty decent track record, you know. I think it's been fun so far. Hopefully, y'all have been enjoying it as much as we have. If you could rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, we would appreciate that very much. You can find a dedicated Twitter feed for the podcast itself at The Roost Pod. And then, of course, you can find everything that's posted on the site at The Roost. All right. Well, our guest for this week is former Rice cross-country athlete, recently awarded Fulbright Scholar. And this one is just as important as the other two, longtime Twitter mutual of mine, Adolfo Carvalho. How are you, man?
I'm great. Nice to be here.
So which one of those are you most proud of? And you don't have to say the truth.
It's been a good ride being mutuals with Carter, I gotta say.
Yeah, we've been internet friends for a long time. So now that you're blowing up and everybody knows who you are, I feel like I was, kind of on the hipster train there. It's like, oh yeah, that guy messaged me on Facebook when he was in high school.
I remember that. Yeah, that was. I remember actually, you were really big in helping me get to Rice, or helping me choose Rice in the end. Learning about their physics department and stuff. So,
thank partial you for credit.
That. Yeah, no, look at me.
Wait, do we do that? Is partial credit exist at Rice? Can we do that?
Yeah. Close enough.
Rice adjacent, as far as the podcast goes. They don't want credit for all of our ramblings. Well, before we get to maybe more trivial, I guess we'll start off at the top with the last. Well, I guess all time is kind of run together for me. I don't know what the difference between days and weeks and months are, but you at some point, yeah, you ended your Rice career, winning the Bob Quinn Award given every year to the most outstanding male student athlete at Rice. So since part of what you did at Rice is related to the athletic side, we wanted to hit that off the top and just kind of get your thoughts on whether or not you saw something like that coming and what that means with given such a wide array of very talented athletes at Rice.
I definitely couldn't have imagined that one coming. You know, when I got to Rice, I was a walk-on onto the cross country team, and definitely not keeping up on the workouts for the first year or so. So it was, I remember, you know, sitting at Night of the Owl and watching everyone each year get it. You know, people like Scott Phillip and Charlie Cardshoulders who competed at USA's, and you know, the history of the award with former Olympians and national champions. So that was definitely not something that I could have imagined myself reaching one day. So it's been a really exciting time in the last couple of years as things have really come together for me.
Yeah. So, and
you know that you had walked on. Is there a Rudy movie in the making?
There might be. No. Yeah. I did. I walked on. I actually wasn't on a scholarship until this past year, and I didn't. I remember I had to earn gear for the first couple months. So.
What was it like? You run a mile and they give you a Gatorade, you run another mile and they give you tape, like.
No, John's not that rough on us. But it is, you know, you earn the travel backpack and the shoes and stuff like that. So you kind of, or you're on your own to have like running clothes and shoes and all that until you really truly make the team. So that was, there's a couple of months there of making do.
I'm curious just from because you were in athletic parlance, I guess, a redshirt senior this year. working on a master's in space science. So like just from a like a student life perspective, I'm curious as a fellow Rice grad, like what this year was kind of like for you, because you got your undergrad last year. So I mean, were you essentially just doing like research and running this year? Like was that kind of I guess I'm sort of asking what goes into that space science master's, but also just like what kind of the look of this year was for you.
It's a little more coursework intensive. And because this, you know, I really did want to make it clear to, this was something I was very conscious of in deciding to take on the master's, was what was it going to look like for me as a PhD applicant? And I was really, you know, looking at how, you know, and talking to faculty going into that decision, like, how would you look at someone who has this extra year of master's on them? Because, you know, in academia, there can be a little bit of stigma about what you're doing with that extra time if you're not going directly from undergrad.
For those not, and I can speak as someone who applied to physics grad schools himself and whose wife has a PhD in physics. It's pretty typical in these, like, it's not something like the actual graduate program I did, which was law school. Like, that's something that's very normal for people to take a long amount of time off. But in a lot of, not in all academic, like, PhD programs, but in the natural sciences in particular, like, it's most people go straight through. Like for those of you that aren't familiar with it, this is not, like, a normal track to take. Normally, you come straight out of undergrad without any sort of, people don't usually earn a separate master's. Like, a lot of times you get a master's as part of your PhD program, but something like this is not as common in that track.
Exactly. And a couple of the courses I've taken, I'll actually end up repeating as part of their course requirements for the PhD program. So that is, you know, I was very conscious of that. And as such, I really wanted to make sure that I could continue rigorous coursework and kind of, So I ended up kind of extending a rhythm just like my undergrad was into a fifth year. So it was almost like getting to do a fifth year of undergrad in terms of the rigor of the physics courses and math courses that I was taking, which was, that's valuable in the end, though it's not easy.
I was just about to ask, at Beer Bike, were you with Duncan or, because you were at Duncan, right?
Yes.
I was going to ask if you were at Duncan or GSA, but that's sort of a loose question.
I was kind of curious.
What were you planning on? I guess is the.
I was definitely gonna. I still knew some people at Duncan, so I was gonna, you know, pay my respects there and go by the alumni and talk to them. But I was gonna see what's up at the GSA tent. It always looked like they're having a good time, so I figured since they won't kick me out, I'll swing by.
Yeah.
It's been interesting bridging that for sure. I can't thank the Duncan Magisters enough for being so welcoming. The whole Duncan A team and the West Servery dining staff really were huge in making me still feel at home at Duncan, because, you know, I didn't leave, so there wasn't that gap. So I still knew a couple of people, but not a lot. And so I would, you know, so I'd come by for lunch, and then Caleb, the now famous Caleb McDaniel, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his work in history. He and Brandy McDaniel, the Duncan Magisters, would always invite me to eat with them. And so that helped keep everything still kind of like I was an undergrad in that sense. It was nice.
Feel like we've reached full Rice Pod status. We've dropped Pulitzer Prize winning folks, and we've talked about various different awards in academia.
Yeah, well, trust me, we're gonna get even ricier on this one, so down the hatch, deal.
Yeah, this one could get
So I was curious now, granted, we were not technically this, because I was just a general physics major, and astrophysics is technically a separate major, although they overlap basically until like second semester junior year.
Yeah.
So don't know. I mean, I'm sure the professors for a lot of the classes have changed out. But what was your favorite up through the part where we overlapped? And I guess you could talk about an astro one too if there's one that really stands out. But what was your favorite physics class at Rice, and who was your favorite professor?
Oh boy, my favorite physics class at Rice would have probably had to be. I'm gonna reference some new professors, but I took a cosmology class with Mustafa Amin, who's a brand new faculty there in theoretical cosmology. That was a really good one. In terms of classes we might have had in common, I really enjoyed classical mechanics, actually.
Okay. 301?
Yeah. And that one...
Who was teaching that when you took it?
So that was Caden Hazard's second year taking it. He's okay. He's one of their new theoretical quantum guys. And he's brilliant and a really nice guy and a lot of fun. But the person who was doing the, I don't know if y'all had this, it was recitations, right? The like once a week, hour long or 2 hour long thing. And I had that with, the Dr. Marjorie Corcoran.
Oh, you had,
that was my last class with her.
Yeah. I had 201 with her.
I had her for 201 as well.
Sorry, not 201, 202.
Two. Yes. Right. Yeah. You had me going. No, the modern physics.
Yeah.
Yes. I got that.
It's all basically Greek to me. Although I think if we're going through our Rice bingo squares, what was it? Theoretical cosmology. I don't think we got that one now.
I really my favorite class was actually 311, the first semester quantum mechanics.
Yeah. Who'd you have for that one?
Padley.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
He's great. He makes that class for back when he used it. I very nearly took. So he teaches or used to teach a class called Physics for Citizenship, which is basically like a D3 credit for non-physics majors. If you just want to take something fun. I've heard it's basically that he like lights stuff on fire and talks about nuclear power. So I very nearly took that the second semester of my senior year, but I knew, one, it was at like 8 a.m. and I was like, no, I'm not doing that. And two, I knew if I walked in there on the first day that Padley was going to look at me and be like, get out. What are you doing here?
It's funny how 8 a.m. in college is a different world once you get past it and the rest of the world decides to function at 7 a.m. and 6 a.m. and before the sun comes up.
Yeah, I mean, when I got to law, like, I had several, like, 8:15 and 8:20 classes at law school in the first year, just because those were the ones, because your whole first year at law school, no matter where you are, is prescribed exactly for you. And I had never, because, like, the earliest any required physics class started at Rice was 9 o'clock. So I had never had a class before 9 o'clock. And so these 8:15 classes in law school, I was like, what is this? It's terrible.
Yeah, 8 a.m.'s with track are extra brutal because you have to, that means you have to do your run at 6, like start at the latest at 6 a.m. And then you're still like sprinting, holding breakfast to get to class.
I'm picturing you going full like Flintstones here.
it's something like that. All my professors, got used to me eating a full breakfast in class, eggs, bacon, and breakfast potatoes, the whole deal.
So what was it? And I know your experience might have been unique doing the cross country angle, but what was it like doing both at Rice and simultaneously? You know, the student athlete is the colloquialism that we've thrown at people who do what you do or did. but what is it like trying to juggle, you know, aspirations of being an astrophysicist and also you like running? Or I hope you like running, otherwise that was
I did. No, I sure did. It's interesting. There's a very real push and pull, and just because there are 24 hours in a day, and there was the extra difficulty was that there were some things that I would have liked to do that didn't get to do. because astronomy is observational astronomy is done at night. And so there were I was lucky enough, my the I call him my research advisor, like a mentor, Dr. Chris Johnscroll in the astronomy department, who's just a tremendous person and really has helped me a lot and at Rice. He invited me along on a couple of observational, let me take part and help in some observational campaigns that they did with one of the smaller telescopes at McDonald Observatory, which I didn't get to go there. But he worked with me to help me get some nights in when I was off season, kind of. But that's, you just pull an all-nighter, and that's how you get your data, is you just run the telescope. And you can do it remotely, fortunately. So I was doing it from Herman Brown Hall. But, you know, I'm sitting in an office at Herman Brown Hall starting at 8 p.m. and I leave at 5 a.m. and still have to do classes and practice. So that's why you kind of wait till the off-season to do that. But the first year at Rice was really, really, really hard because I was running double what I'd ever run in high school, literally. And then trying to do Rice classes on top of that was very difficult to stack the two. But there are a lot of nights where you're wondering, what is it? You know, am I going to be able to? There are a lot of nights where it's like, you know, I know I could definitely get the right answer if I had another hour, but warm up is at 5:30 tomorrow morning. And so you really make, you have to make that kind of judgment a lot. But I loved it. My time at Rice was incredibly fulfilling the whole time through. And, it's, you know, if it wasn't for getting used to how tough, cross country was and just being used to sacrificing to get things done on the track, I wouldn't have developed the toughness that I think it takes to be able to work in astronomy and deal with some of the sometimes frustrating elements of it. So I really enjoyed juggling the two. It's been really, really a special experience, but it's a lot of professors not realizing that there's an athlete in their class because it's a 400 level physics class. And so I got a lot of, I remember, was David Alexander was around when you were there, right, Carter? Did you ever meet him?
The name sounds familiar, but I mean, is he an astro professor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then I recognize John Scroll's name, but like, I didn't take any classes with any astro professors. So. The name doesn't ring a bell.
No, he just, it was, he is a, he told me when, I was taking solar system physics with him. And, that was a 400, 454 or something like that. And, I was taking it with him, and he comes up to me like halfway through the semester, and they have to send these like progress reports to athletics, like athletics, yeah, kind of bugs the professors and says like, hey, how's our person doing? And so he walked up to me and he was like, yeah, I was wearing a cross country shirt. And he was like, you're on the cross country team, right? I was like, yes. He's like, I was so, you know, I got one of those emails from the athletics department, and I'm used to responding to those for the 201, 202 class, which is the essentially like that physics citizenship type class.
We had a very uncharitable name for that one when I was in school, which I will very much not repeat on this podcast.
I wasn't about to be the one to volunteer it. But yes, that's the one. And he's like, yeah, I'm used to filling those out for that one. But when I got the email, I thought, there's no athletes in my class. And so, you know, there's those little moments here and there, but it was a tremendously positive experience on both sides. And John Warren, our coach, always gets a kick out of saying the major. So.
Yeah. Well, this one might be a tough one since you are very recently removed from the experience, maybe, than for some of our guests who have been out a long time. But do you have a favorite non-sports rice memory at this point?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Too close, right?
A little bit, yeah. That's...
We might let you pick two. Our rules bend.
I would say one of them was for sure, it's kind of tied to sports, but it's technically astronomy. But this is in big part because of my gratefulness to Dr. John Sproul. My senior year, we were discussing, you know, opportunities to present my work and my research. And he was mentioning the Texas Astronomy Undergraduate Research Symposium, TORS. And it was being hosted at University of Texas. And, you know, he was used at this point to me saying, like, I can't do that. I have a meet that weekend. But it was on a Friday morning. And, I said, I can't do that. I have a meet that weekend at A&M on Saturday morning. And he said, well, you know, it's not a long drive. Said, right?
In Texas terms, I guess it's not.
No. <yeah. laughs> I was like, well, I guess not. And then Dr. John Sproul says, well, if I can drive you to College Station after you present, would your coach let you go? And I was like, I'll have to ask him, but maybe. And so I asked John, and John was fine with it. And so I go out Thursday night. I get to spend the night in Austin in this nice little bed and breakfast. Go the next morning, give my talk at like 9 a.m. or something. And then Dr. John Sproul drives me the like hour and a half from, or 2 hours or something, from College Station all the way from Austin all the way to College Station, and then proceeds to drive himself down to Rice to get back home, just so that I could give like a 30-minute talk and then race. And so that was really cool getting to do that and get that opportunity, just because he was so fantastic in that moment.
That's great. It's if anyone from Rice actually listens to this, they'll be, it's like we're cutting an ad for the university right here, like, Rice professors, they care.
I mean, because when they do the ad, right, that runs on TV, you got to have, well, there's the music. So there's there's probably a cello, like Gabe Baker's probably sitting there in the corner at one point. Yeah. And then you got to show, you know, Rice Stadium is in the ad. And then there's a beaker with some liquid in it.
Yeah,
there would have to be. Yeah.
I was in one of those once, actually, which, like, first of all, it's very weird to see a Rice ad on TV because, you know, it's not the sort of school that normally, like, does TV advertisement for itself. Like, you know, imagine if you saw, like, an ad for Harvard on TV. Like,
yeah,
exactly that sort of thing. But this was, like, 2017 or 2018? I think it was 2018, because I want to say it was last year baseball made regionals. It was the year they were like under 500 going into the tournament, and they had to win the tournament to make it into the regional.
That might have been 2018.
I think it was 2018, yeah, because I think it was 2 years ago was the last time they made it. And so I was at my parents' house in Birmingham, and I'm watching like that whatever game's on during the CUSA tournament, and the Rice ad comes on, and I'm like, oh, it's the Rice ad. This is going to win. It's always weird. And they had a clip from a play that I was in. The theater department did A Midsummer Night's Dream actually the semester after I graduated, and I kind of got like invited to come back and audition for it. And I was in that production, and there was a clip from it, like with me on stage in this ad, literally like 5 years after the production.
That's so
weird. I was like, what is happening right now?
Yeah, that's really funny.
Hey, name, image, and likeness is becoming the hot button issue, right? Are they gonna comp you for your 2 second theater spot?
Yeah, well, and the reason it's in there is because they don't have to comp Shakespeare for that. So I think the video of that performance is actually still on YouTube, because they filmed it and put the video up because it's, you know, it's in the public domain because it's Shakespeare. So I'm sure that's the reason they used it. Anyway, so to post-Rice things, obviously the other big thing that's happened for you recently is the Fulbright scholarship, which is a very big deal. You're going to study protoplanetary disks in Chile? Yes?
Yes.
I guess the first thing I'm curious about with that is what does the plan for that look like now? Is the timeline for that still intact with, you know, gestures at the world?
Yeah. Fortunately, yes. Because it was going to be a weird timeline to begin with. I'm just hanging out until March 2021. And that was the plan all along. So hopefully by then things will have cooled off.
So have you learned any new hobbies or how are you going to keep busy for another nine, 10 months? Math is hard.
Something like that. Right now I'm in kind of a push and pull with the administration for my PhD program to see if I can start it early and then leave. Because they said it was different from deferring. It would be called leave at that point, which makes sense. But I also want to know, you know, are there ramifications for that, consequences or any financial aid or anything like that? So I'm waiting for that right now. And so if I get my way on that, then I might be heading out to California in September or October to start the, I'll be able to do the start of my PhD, and then I'll head out to Chile after that. But otherwise, I'm going to have to come up with a way to take up a lot of time.
That's a lot of running.
Yeah. it'll be interesting. I might end up running more than I was in college.
Don't let your coach hear that.
Start ultra marathoning just out of sheer boredom.
Yeah, maybe.
Hey, I know a couple friends that have picked up Ironmans after school just for fun.
I'm not
if
good
that's
at
your idea of fun.
Those people have very different definitions of fun than I do.
Yeah, I believe it. I'll pass on that. And Carter, you alluded to this at the beginning, where we've calling this our extended off season, right? And if we've been going for 2 months, then that means sports are about to start, because that's how long the off season is supposed to be. But maybe not. But one of the off season topics that kind of has been starting to swirl around is. And I wanted to get your take on this as somebody who competed, I guess, and probably a more regionalized schedule than most, but people are talking about with cost cutting and stuff. And of course, you know, football and basketball are kind of the drivers, but it impacts everywhere else down of the possibility, especially in Olympic sports, playing a more regionalized schedule and, going up to a College Station in Austin and not taking any meets that are, you know, or fewer meets that are further away. What was the furthest that you traveled in your time running? And, you know, you mentioned that the trade-offs of literally having to drive from an academic event to an athletic event and back and forth. Is that something that you would kind of view? Maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth. What would you think about that being a change that could be happening in the near future?
So John did a really good job of getting us to whatever meets he thought we needed to be at to compete and succeed. First off, and second, you know, we have a huge conference. I read your breakdown on the Sun Belt COSA realignment that might happen. So you know, we end up we had conference last year in outdoor track at Charlotte, North Carolina. We went to Boca Raton, Florida for cross country the fall before that. This past fall, we went to Bowling Green, Kentucky. We go to Birmingham, Alabama every year for indoor track. It's a nice crossplex y'all got there. And we've gone to Los Angeles twice to run in outdoor track. So Los Angeles once and San Diego another time. And we've taken small groups of 10K runners over to San Francisco to run a couple of times. So John, you know, when he can get us out there, he flies us out to if he thinks there will be good competition, and that's going to help us, you know, qualify for regional meets and stuff like that later. He'll get us there. This year we were going to go out to Kansas so the throwers could have some good competition at Kansas at one of the big Kansas meets, and the runners were going to go out to LA again to compete at Mount SAC, which is a really big distance runner track meet. So John really gets us around. But on the other hand, like last year, we hardly left the area. Spring 2019, for outdoor track, I think the furthest we went was Charlotte for that conference meet. But otherwise, we ran at Arkansas, A&M a bunch of times, Houston a bunch of times, UT. So we stay, you know, pretty local because the local competition is so good in track that we don't usually have to go very far to get really good competition. And Texas, A&M is growing some really big meets, and Houston just got a new indoor track. So kind of each year I've been here, we've had to go less far just because the local running scene has gotten better and better. But I think it'll be tough. I think there's, these long trips were some of my favorite parts of track. Going out, we went to Nashville for an indoor meet, and we got to run against Vanderbilt and a couple of other schools out there, some SEC schools. And we raced Saturday morning, but we got to go there on Thursday night. So, like, I went to a Predators hockey game.
Of that was the actual competition? And
I mean, most of it was just John kind of treating us, you know. But a lot of it, you know, fortunately also Rice has a really generous donor base, who have been really supportive generally of the athletic program. We have a pretty rich history in track, so we have a decent donor base there. And, so we are able to, you know, those more extravagant trips are done through that more so than so much coming out of our base university funding. So we'll see what happens. John, I sat in on a team meeting recently where John kind of mentioned that, you know, we're not going to go to Los Angeles or anything like that, probably next year, or the guys won't. But there's, like I mentioned, there's fortunately really good competition in the very nearby area. You wouldn't even have to go more than 3 or 4 hours to get some of the best competition in the country.
All right. Yeah. Well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's interesting you mentioned that the CUSA Sunbelt piece up on the site. So one person read it, so that is a good thing. but I thought it was interesting. I put a poll under that on Twitter, and I guess the results just finished up today. And I said, would you like to see some sort of merger realignment, you know, between the Sun Belt and COSA, and just in general, a more regionalized schedule, you know, splitting it and playing more teams in Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, et cetera. And 75% said yes, they would like to see realignment. And then I said, do you think it will actually happen to some degree? And 43% think it will happen. So take that for what you will. But
yeah.
I mean, obviously, if track is already, you know, talking about staying local to some degree for next season, it'd be interesting to see what happens with the rest of the sports. Have no crystal ball.
Yeah, I think it's tough. The big travel costs are really expensive, or you know, they're quite high, but a lot of it is also very fixed. Like, if you can't get there by bus, you have to fly. And then, you know, when you're flying a bunch of people, it adds up, but, you know, oftentimes it doesn't end up mattering, I think, too much how far you really fly. hotel costs are kind of all the same. So I think I'm not sure how much some of those trips would change, and especially if you're having to go against conference opponents anyway, you have to go all the way to Old Dominion, like you mentioned in the article, if our track conference meet is in Charlotte or Old Dominion or Boca Raton, we're gonna go there. you can't really choose to stay local there. So there is that element of it that there, if you have to, when you have to build your schedule around conference competition, especially with the big, with the other sports that where their conference, their regular season does matter. It becomes harder to do that when the conference is so spread out.
I mean, if you're picking and choosing, again, you could do worse than Charlotte and Boca Raton.
That's true.
But I'm not going to, because if I call anyone out here, I will hear about it from friends. But there are some CUSA destinations that probably you don't mind not going back to. And I can probably say the same.
I can agree to that without dropping any names.
I'm just kidding. Missed a trip to the Frisco with the Star with everything getting shut down. So next year.
All right, now comes the portion where we pivot to being the premier pop culture hot takes podcast, since we have several times at this point, gone off, quit the recording and then had serious discussion of, ranking Spider-Man movies and these sorts of things that we want to get on the pod for. Because that's what the content everyone clamors for. So today we're going to talk about Star Wars. I think you told me that you and your roommate have watched, you watch all of them every year or something like that.
We started it on May the 4th, 2018 or something. Duncan had just finished their brand new movie room. May the 4th falls right during our dead days, so nobody had anything to do. We had just come out of practice, and I got some kind of a... I promise I didn't have notifications set for this, but I got some kind of a notification saying, there's, an ABC... ABC is streaming all the movies all day. And I was like, Duncan just built our movie room. Let's get over there and watch. And so... it was Alex Dunbar, who's a distance runner who just graduated also. And a couple of other guys, we all packed into the movie room and just spent all day there. Essentially, we left for lunch, came back, watched some more, went for dinner, came back, continued watching. And we were like, what if we do this every dead days, as a tradition? So every semester we watch all of the current movies. So, they've been adding movies since we started doing this. But that's been really cool because then they're always releasing them kind of June or December or so. So we were able to, we watch all the movies up until the newest one. And then we get to go to the movie theater and watch the newest one. So we've been able to do that a couple of times, which is really fun.
All right. So give me your rank of all 11 live action movies. We will not include the Clone Wars movie in this official ranking right here.
I appreciate that. we'll see. My roommates might be mad at me for this one. Cause we always discuss it too, but I think my favorite top movie is Rogue One.
Okay.
I completely agree.
Just a good movie. It's a fantastic, story in general. It's a good war movie. If it's going to be Star Wars, it's one of the true war movies in the whole story. And that end, from the moment that the Death Star shows up on the horizon and they give you that horizon shot, essentially until the credits go, I got goosebumps. So it's a tremendous movie.
My ranking changes literally every time I think about it. I am of constantly shifting opinions, but Rogue One is usually in my top three. And the one I did today, so I'd be prepared for this, it was three.
Oh boy. All right. Well, maybe I'll hit another one in your top three here. I guess maybe controversially, I'll say The Last Jedi is my number two.
Okay.
Controversial to some, not I have it fourth. I went a little so I'll just give my full ranking.
All right, let's hear yours and we can compare.
So in order as of today, I went classical. I said Empire and A New Hope 1-2, Rogue One 3, Last Jedi 4, Return of the Jedi 5. This one might be the hot take. Rise of Skywalker 6, Force Awakens 7, Revenge of the Sith 8, Solo 9, Clones 10, Phantom Menace 11.
Interesting. All right. I kind of forget about Solo. I did too.
I kept staring at it. I was like, what have I forgotten? I was like, oh, right, Solo happened.
I kind of like, it's not top five rating, but I kind of like Solo. Okay. It's a fun movie. Like,
it was a movie that like I enjoyed watching. I don't know if I like it's on my rewatch list to go like immediately watch again, but I was like, oh, okay.
It's pretty fun. It's fun in the there were a couple of things that got a lot better when we marathoned them. Solo was one of them.
Okay.
Interesting. Which was because the way we did it was we watched them chronologically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you do all the prequels and then you start this slow build toward the Skywalkers, toward the true, you know, Skywalker saga. And in that slow build, you get Solo and you build up who he is and everything. And then you get Rogue One with that beautiful transition directly into A New Hope. So that really strengthens it a lot.
But I'll
come back to the merits of marathoning them in a second. let's see. So I got The Last Jedi 2. I'd say Empire's 3. A New Hope is 4. So
yeah, we have the same top 4, just in a different order there.
Yeah. And then I'd have to put Revenge of the Sith, which is, I know, really high for a prequel. But
I know people that put Sith high. And Sith has, I mean, like the, I don't know, on the strength of the Anakin Obi-Wan duel alone, like that is a considerable merit in and of itself. And when I'm, like I said, I change my mind every time I do this, but like when I'm feeling charitable towards that, like that bumps it up a lot. It just, in the parts that are not that, it has the same problems that all the other ones do, in that it's just like George Lucas can't write dialogue to save his life.
That is my. I will always come to the defense of the fact that Hayden Christensen portrayed the lines he was given. He was just given bad lines.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
no,
they,
no.
They gave this man like believable, play angsty teen for 3 hours, and he was like, "All right, if this is what you want."
Yeah, it's not his fault. The line was, from my point of view, the Jedi are evil.
Exactly. But it is, I mean, I like it a lot. It has just fantastic lightsaber duels and like some of the most, and just that really satisfying play that they do to get him over to the dark side in I think just the right way, with it's a nice build, I think, to really lay the groundwork for the Empire, in a way that, you know, like Rogue One does better.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one, it's a good like setting the scene movie that really leaves you ready to just pick up the original trilogy, which is nice.
Yeah, it's, and definitely like even in my least charitable towards Sith moments, the gap between it and the other prequels is substantial. I think it suffers for the other two being so bad. Like, if they were better and progressed more logically to it, like, I don't think, like, in Clones, we don't see, like, the dark side really potential in Anakin, I don't think. I think it's, like, he's an angsty teenager. And then,
yeah, and he has that, like, vague discussion of fascist tendencies
yeah
with Padme, but there's not a lot there. Yeah, they do. I've been watching the Clone Wars TV series, and that gets you there.
Yeah, yeah. I've needed to do that for you. I was so skeptical of it when it first started airing that I was like, no, this is not going to be any good at all. And then I keep hearing that it's wonderful, and it took me a long time to get over that initial like skepticism, and now it's just become another thing on the like, you know. That list everybody has at this point that's like,
yeah,
here's the 400 shows I need to watch.
Yeah, I'll add my recommendation to the list. I think it's really good. Yeah. And it does a lot of, if you liked Rogue One, so first season is kind of rocky, but from there on, if you liked Rogue One, it has a lot of that same element, and kind of like The Mandalorian picks up with, which is like, you get to see like Star Wars as it happens on the ground. So yeah. You get to see like arcs following clone troopers and following the Jedi Padawans and stuff in a way that you're like, oh, it's not just like governors and emperors and senators and right. godlike Jedi that fulfill prophecies and stuff. You know, it is like, it feels like a more real world. Just cool.
And you mentioned The Mandalorian, and I will not besmirch Disney in the middle of our Star Wars discussion, but they put out, what was it, like 8, and we have to wait. I need more Baby Yoda.
Yeah. Oh, I know. That's gonna be insane. A year and a half, isn't it?
They keep saying it's like coming back this fall or something like, I don't know. They're sticking to
it. If they push the MJ doc up before it was finished, like, we can make this happen, Disney.
Yeah. I'm really excited. Well, but I don't want them, I'm not gonna make them rush it. I want them I want that thing to live at least a couple of seasons of like good sustained world building that they've been doing.
I would love to see that get, and it's not going to, because this is just not the format that people mostly like make television these days, particularly not like prestige television, but I would love to see it get, like, a lot of people complained about that it had kind of like a monster of the week type deal in the middle of it. And I loved that. I thought that I mean, that's where you do real character. Like, this is, that's like the Star Trek bread and butter. And you mentioned the first season of Clone Wars being rough. Like, I love Star Trek The Next Generation. I can do rough first season, trust me. But, like, I would love to see The Mandalorian get, like, a 20-episode run where it can just do some of that, like, non-serialized, like, character grunt work in the middle of it. I don't think we're ever going to get that. But I actually enjoyed that stuff in the middle of The Mandalorian.
I thought it was really nice. I think it is tough when you like tie it too much together. Because then it does feel like you're just waiting a long time to get that next chapter. And I agree with you. I see what you're saying there.
Yeah, it ended up in an awkward situation where it had that, but it was such a short runtime that it like was kind of awkward, but
I needed a bit more of the overarching thread, right? The middle 4 episodes, it was so compartmentalized that you could have like swapped the order around and nothing mattered. And I was just like, I need a little bit more of the thread. Like, don't tell me where it's going, but just like, show me that there's a direction. He's just not like, okay, are people going to chase him forever? Yes, but.
Yeah, I think it is. I wish that they had had a longer season. Like more episodes in that first season, because I think that is part of what made it feel awkward. Is like, if you were 8 episodes into like a 20 episode season, you might be more like, oh, I see, there, we haven't even started yet. But when you're
right,
episode 5 of 8, and you're still doing, like Carter mentioned, the monster of the week type stuff, then I can see how it's like, where are we going?
There was a dissonance between like those episodes and it being such a short season.
Yeah.
So I understand why people like felt weird about that.
But definitely in the context of like wanting a longer run for the show each season, that would definitely be a really good format to throw some episodes into, for sure. Yeah.
We will write in, dear Disney. I have no doubt, anytime you touch one of those hallowed classics like Star Wars, you get so much feedback.
Oh, it's so, yeah. I think they're doing a really good job, all things considered. I think adopting IP like that can be really fraught, and I think they're doing well.
Yeah.
And so if we're jumping back to the movie rankings, I don't think, had you hit any of the new three yet?
And the Last Jedi.
Yeah. Jedi.
Oh, okay, we did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
how far down the list do we have to get before
Okay. And I'm the worst about this. Let's get through the ranking, and then we'll pick things apart more.
All right, all right. I haven't been doing well either. So, okay. So we got, next I'll do, it kind of shook up with this last rewatch, Rise of Skywalker.
Okay.
So I think you had it 6 as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
Then Return of the Jedi, Force Awakens. I hope I'm not missing any here. Solo. Solo? Yeah. Force Awakens and then Solo. And then Phantom Menace. And then Attack of the Clones.
Did we get Return of the Jedi in there?
Return of the Jedi was 7.
Okay.
Okay, right. I'm close-ish. Okay, so, you know, I got Rogue One, Empire, New Hope, Last Jedi, Return of the Jedi, Sith, Force Awakens, Rise of Skywalker, Solo, Phantom Menace, and Clones.
All right.
I actually went Clones over Phantom Menace this time, and I'm not really sure why. It's usually the other way. I cannot speak to what my mindset was about those two.
If they put a laugh 2 hours track ago to
when
it.
I wrote this down. Yeah, I think Clones, sometimes I have an affection for because it's so memeably terrible. Like, just like the references at this point, it's like I have an affection for it that it probably doesn't deserve.
Now, so what year Clones came out in
2002.
So I remember watching that. Oh, man, how old was I at that point? I remember it. We were kids, right? And so I remember watching it when it came out. And as like a, you know, an elementary school kid, Jar Jar Binks, you're like, this is the funniest movie ever. And then you rewatch it like 10 years later and you're like, oh, I'm cringing.
Yeah, that's between like Jar Jar Binks and the Separatists. There's a lot of painful moments and
accents.
Yeah. Okay, but I want to make sure I get this question in before we get sidetracked. But okay, so every true Star Wars fan has a minor character, i.e. someone who doesn't get like very much screen time at all, who they have like a really outsized like emotional attachment to. Like I was talking to a friend of mine from Rice, who was Big Mercury 15, and his guy is Biggs Darklighter, and my sister and I are crazy about Wedge, and have been for like 20 plus years at this point. Who is your guy? And Boba Fett doesn't count because Boba Fett is totally grown beyond his role at this point. Who's the person that's like in one scene that you're like, that guy, I love that dude?
I gotta think about that one. That one's tough. I always like the dude that greets Obi-Wan. When Obi-Wan when he goes to fight General Grievous in Sith.
Oh, like the Utapauan politician?
Yeah, I think the one with the teeth.
Slits in his face.
Yes, and he's
that's
like
a good one. Yes,
they're holding us hostage. He's a fun one. I don't know what it is about
head dress type thing.
Yeah, and it's I don't know what it is about him, but I always like snap to when he's on screen. I'm like, I gotta see this guy say that again.
That's good. I like that one a lot. That's a deep cut.
And then if I'm gonna pull one, I think the robot droid from Rogue One is a K2SO. I thought he was just one of, like, they, and because the droids are a running joke throughout like the entire like series and like into the movie or the TV shows and everything. Like, I feel like he was actually like their best well done robot.
Droid. K2 is so funny.
It's a solid choice. Yeah.
But like believably not
human. Always funny. Great with the voice work for Alan Tudyk.
I love if we have to pick if I were to pick another guy, he gets a little more screen time though. He's not so much the real obscure one, but, and I'm blanking on his name now, which is bad because I just watched it. But the one from Rise of Skywalker who rewires C-3PO.
Oh, Babu Frick. Yes. Yeah.
He's
that's
so
a solid one.
Just that whole first that scene is just so heartwarming with C-3PO.
Yeah.
But then like just that moment where he's like, first Babu Frick is hilarious, and then later he's like, C-3PO is like, Babu Frick, he's my oldest friend.
I just about threw myself into an IMDb hold, but as soon as you mentioned Alan Tudyk with the droid, I went back and I pulled up his IMDb, and I remembered him from Firefly, which so the sci-fi connection there, fantastic. But I forgot he was Watt in A Knight's Tale, one of Heath Ledger's sidekicks.
He was also okay. So the entire voice cast of Moana. Is of like, you know, some Polynesian, Hawaiian, some type of Pacific Islander descent, which is good. You know, we've come a long way from casting Donny Osmond as the singing voice of Shang in Mulan. The only non-Polynesian actor in Moana is Alan Tudyk, who voices the chicken.
No way.
That's him.
Well, I didn't know.
Star Wars connection, Temuera Morrison, Boba Fett, and Jango Fett. Is Moana's dad.
Yes, I was going to ask about him. I didn't realize he was Polynesian.
Mm-hmm. And so is the crab, the big monster crab dude, is Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords, who is half Maori on his mother's side.
Okay, wow. That is really cool. They really made an effort there.
There we go. We're connecting all the wormholes. And so, and I wanted to, I feel like you, of all the people that have been on this podcast, would be the most qualified to answer this question, as someone who knows more about space than I ever will, and being a big Star Wars fan, I'm assuming none of it can actually happen in real life, but what's the one thing as a science person that you look at that is like almost kind of slightly believable that makes you the most happy? Because I know like most of it's not, but
I'm trying to think if there's anything that is. Like, it might be a better question is, what is the one thing, is there anything in Star Wars?
Right, I want the redeeming quality here.
One thing I do that I love every time, I'm a young star planet formation exoplanets guy, right, as of more recently, but the diversity of worlds that they show, and especially because initially they don't do this as much, and then in the prequels they start to introduce this a little bit more, that whole like, you know, the whole planet is just the one thing, you know, like, and but they managed to yank themselves away from that a little bit after the prequels, which was nice. But they do really a tremendous job of having very diverse worlds. You know, you have like ice, like the you know like Hoth inspired by like icy moons like Europa and stuff, and you have the it's fun that like the forest moon of Endor, so they always, it's like, and they have like the moons of Endor are actually where things happen.
Yavin's the same way. Like Yavin is the gas giant, and the base in A New Hope is on the fourth moon.
Exactly. And so you have those you have that kind of rich diversity of bodies of planetary and satellite bodies that we do actually observe, and there's things like that Dathomir or is like entirely illuminated red because it orbits a red star. And there are those kind of things where it's really rich, and I always fall for the recent movies, essentially since The Force Awakens, where they've really juiced up all the special effects with the planet. So I mentioned in Rogue One that shot of the Death Star on the horizon, and like where you can see they land on planets that have rings, and you can see the rings kind of in the sky, and they do just such a great job with that kind of stuff, really making you feel like this is what you would see if you could stand on this planet. And even, you know, it I love to imagine that kind of stuff. You know, like we've discovered planets that do orbit binary stars. So a Tatooine sunset is not out of the question. So that kind of stuff, especially, you know, he imagined Tatooine with two suns, because in the 70s they knew there were binary stars, but we didn't discover the first exoplanet until 1995.
Cool. I like that you, from the astro, like big picture perspective, that you were able to find something like that. Because when I was as a general physics person, when I was, my brain was at its most physics-y, all I can see in terms of stuff like that is like I remember my initial reaction to the scene in The Force Awakens when they fire Starkiller Base, and somehow in a planet in an entirely, like, you have like they're on Maz's planet, and then Starkiller is off in another system in a different part of the galaxy, and the Hosnian system where the Republic is a different, and somehow they can just see it in the sky. That's not how space works.
Yeah, that one was pretty bad. The moment my roommate, it was funny, my roommate, is, you know, Alex Dunbar, I mentioned earlier, is a math guy, he's a math cam, mm-hmm. and double major, not,
yeah.
And I remember we were both watching Force Awakens at the same time, and he was like, I love how when Starkiller Base blows up, it turns into a star again. And I was like, that's the one thing I hated. Like, what are you talking about? Like, if you compactify all of the energy of a star, like you can feed on a star and you bring in that energy, and we're going to imagine you can stabilize it and harness it. Sure, I'll allow that. And then you blow this thing up. You have the special effects. Make a supernova. It's going to go supernova. If it's compact enough, you're going to have this gorgeous neutron star that you could animate. It'll look awesome. It'll be so cool. You can even hire the interstellar guys to come in and do your neutron star physics to get that nice disk that's going to be around it and all that crazy stuff. Like, it'll look awesome. That'll be so cool to animate. Don't just make it a star again. That's so boring.
The least interesting choice.
So on two folds, the lack of boom boom, and then the actual science behind it. All of the sins of Star Wars.
Yeah, no, that was, I allow them a lot of that, like, you know, yeah. Okay, sure, lightsabers and laser guns and light speed gets you across a galaxy, sure, but
well, you got to swing one way or another, right? As someone who understands how all the pieces works, you either have to love it or you have to hate it. Like,
it's yeah, you kind of just allow like
5%. It's weird what your brain, like, after you had a science, like, you have a science degree, like, what your brain will like allow and what it won't. Like, what you're saying, like, oh, I can accept that, like, somehow, like, crystal and a little like handle thing generates like a stable plasma arc that they can wield like a sword, but you know, my brain goes crazy when I see, like, the bombs falling like they're in an atmosphere in Last Jedi. Like, I have no idea, like, where the selector is that sometimes I'm just like, sure, that's fine. And sometimes I'm just like, that's not real.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's a lot of, I always wonder, this is the other thing I was just scratching my head about. So in Return of the Jedi, the new base that they're making. No, sorry, not in Return of the Jedi. In A New Hope, the Death Star is orbiting, right?
Yeah, like around before they're gonna fire on the base. Yeah.
Yeah. Is this the base on Yavin still, I think?
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's orbiting, it's distinctly orbiting Yavin, right? And so you got this, so it kind of puts into notion in there the idea that the Death Star is gonna be orbiting. Which is fine. But then in like no other
Which is fine, but
in none of the other space battles do you have this notion that you're orbiting, and so free fall physics is what's going on. In all the other space battles, they kind of assume that everything is actually in you know, static in the planetary reference frame, so that, you know, if you blow the engines on a cruiser, it's going to crash into the planet. But if I were to do a starfight, I would think that the less you'd spend a lot less fuel if you were just orbiting, is my point.
Well, go to Chile, and then once it's all wrapped up, we'll come back and say I have some ideas.
All right. Well, I certainly could keep going on this forever, but we've run a little while now, so we probably ought to wrap it up. Thanks so much for coming on. This was a lot of fun. It's always good to get off the hot Star Wars takes.
It's a good time for sure. Thank you.
And now I feel like we all have homework to go watch Star Wars and add it to our queue of quarantine movies.
Yeah. I gotta finish. We just restarted Avatar: The Last Airbender on Netflix, and my wife's never seen it, so I gotta drive the bus through that.
I've actually never seen it either, and I just started rewatching it with my girlfriend, and she's also doing the driving.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks to those of you who, hopefully, we managed to get a couple of Star Wars fans who wanted to stick this out with us. But thanks for those of you that have been listening. Stay tuned. We'll have more coming for y'all in the future. And Rice Fight.
This show was edited and produced by Carter Spires. It features music from Joseph McDade.